waiting to have the last two parts.
Yeah.
Until I have them all here.
Oh, that's good. Yeah. I actually just took a little nail in the back of my shoe. So.
That was my plan, but they kind of got upset about
it. Oh, I know. They don't like
it. They're still freaking.
Tax Reform Division of the Senate Committee on Taxes will come to order. Today is Tuesday, February 12th. The first item on the agenda is approval of the minutes from the hearing on Wednesday, February 6th. Are there any corrections? Seeing none, Senator Eaton moves that the minutes from February 6th be approved. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. Today we're going to hear two specific proposals on tax increment financing with regard to Oakdale and Dakota County. But first we're going to receive the report that the state auditor prepares annually on the use of tax increment throughout the state of Minnesota. Auditor Otto, Ms. Nord, if you'd come forward. We're happy to have you here.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Rebecca Otto, the state auditor. It's our pleasure to be here at 9 o'clock in the morning to talk about a 30,000-foot view of tax increment financing in the state, and I know you're all very eager to hear what's going on. So we're really happy to be here.
Some
to
of us
this.
Really are.
It's fabulous stuff. So we will keep it extraordinarily interesting and then attempt to answer your questions. And so what we're going to present is the highlights of the report. We're going to do it in graphic form for the most part, which is just a nice way to present the data, and there is a table with some numbers to illustrate something else. I'm calling this our 2012 TIF legislative report. We are required by statute to issue it annually. The main thing that is normally in there are any findings we found during reviews of select districts and the conclusions of those findings. But we also include data from that has been reported to our office, and Jason will cover the scope and methodology. I want to take a brief moment to introduce our new TIF division director. As you may know, Arlen Welty was the director for several years, and we are very fortunate to have Jason Nord, who was with Department of Revenue, who knows property taxes inside and out, with our office now leading that division. So we really feel we have a great asset in the office, and if it's okay, Madam Chair, I'll turn it over to Jason.
Thank you, Auditor Otto. We members in their packets do not have the full report, and I am having copies of the press release that you issued made so that they can have some of the highlights, and we can certainly make, if people want the full report. Do you have copies?
Madam Chair, we have some.
Oh, terrific. Okay.
We don't print many, but we grabbed what we had, and we'd be happy to provide them to members who would care to look at them.
Fine. We'll ask the
He is going to make copies.
He's making copies. The committee secretary will come and get those from you. What they do is list every single TIF district, I guess, from 2010 or 11.
This data is from calendar year 11.
11, so that you can look and see in your own cities where what kind of projects were used. And we'll return these copies to the state auditor, but we can make them available. I downloaded it and printed it myself. But certainly the to take a look at the press release, which being copied, and members in particular following along might want to look at the executive summary and the overall statistics that you're providing with us. But Mr. Nord, you're very welcome in this committee, and we're pleased to have you present the report.
Madam Chair, thank you very much. I'm happy to be here. So I'll just jump right in and jump right in to kind of presenting some of the highlights again and some of the key graphs that illustrates the information of how tax increment finance is utilized in Minnesota. And to start out with some of you who may not be as familiar with tax increment financing, maybe wondering what tax increment financing is or how it's supposed to work. And simply, tax increment financing is a statutory tool to promote economic development, redevelopment, and housing development in areas that would not otherwise occur. And one of the key parts of a tax increment financing district is the authority needs to make a finding that, but for the use of TIF, the development would not likely to occur. And so it's generally meant to stimulate that type of development. To condense it into a picture, this graph, which I borrowed from a Department of Revenue report, does a pretty good job of illustrating how TIF conceptually in an ideal world is supposed to work. So you might imagine a parcel that is fully developed and it's blighted, and the value of the parcel is either low or declining. And nothing is likely to happen with that parcel, but
and
for some.
And how does the TIF law define blight when you say something is blighted?
Sure, Madam Chair, there is a definition in. I don't think that the term blight itself is directly identified in statute, but
substandard buildings, right. Is usually I think the term that you use.
Right, Madam Chair. Yeah, there's some substandard. There's a couple of different tests. It has to meet a certain amount of coverage. In other words, the parcel has to be covered by improvements to a certain degree, and then those improvements themselves need to be identified to a certain degree as being substandard. And so it's a little bit complicated as to how precisely that's defined, and there's actually been some court cases that have ruled on in different ways on how that blight test is met. So kind of a lot to get into, but just kind of conceptually knowing that a property might be blighted and needing improvement, what happens with tax increment financing is first the TIF plan is enacted, and what that does is it says that from that point in time that it sets an original taxable value, so that at that point in time that value is available to all the taxing jurisdictions for its normal taxing purposes. But once development occurs and the value of the property increases, and then the TIF plan identifies the expenditures on public improvements that will help stimulate that development, but once that value increases, the difference between that original value and the new higher value is called the captured value. And so that captured value is not included when you're calculating tax rates. So it doesn't affect the other taxing jurisdictions and what your normal levy needs to pay for. But it essentially creates an extra amount of incremental tax revenue that is used to pay for those public investments that were able to initiate the development in the first place. And so once the TIF district terminates, now all the jurisdictions benefit from a higher tax base. So that's kind of the conceptual illustration of what tax increment financing is all about.
Madam Chair.
Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Nord, I don't know if you're the person that would have the answer to this or not, but we had a little discussion earlier about that captured value. Do you know how school equalizing formulas dealt with that value that is being captured there and how that interacts with the school funding. Are you familiar with that?
Pre-91.
Yeah, Madam Chair and Senator Skoy, the school financing formulas, and I'm not perfectly up to date on them, but generally they identify that if a school district is getting revenue from whatever variety of sources, that revenue offsets the amount of aid that they get from the state. And in years gone by, there was a great amount of concern by the state and at the legislature about how much TIF was affecting education funding. I think the reforms back in 2001 cut the school district share enough that I think after that reform took place, there wasn't as much attention paid towards tax increment financing and its impact on education funding. But the current state of that, I'm not sure if anybody's spent a lot of time talking or thinking about where we're at today with that.
And Madam Chair, the reason I brought it up, Mr. Nord, is because the governor's education task force recommended restoring some general education levy. And I was wondering if this was an area that we would have to pay attention to if that was to move forward.
Mr. Nord.
Madam Chair and Senator Skoy, I know certainly that's a policy consideration that that you could talk about and think about. But if what would happen is once a tax increment financing district captures value, that value is not available for any of the levies such as the general education levy, depending probably on how it's structured. The state tax, for example, is not part of, it does not get captured. So the state tax on CI and commercial not industrial affected. Property isn't part of this. And so it probably would depend on how that general education revenue is structured. But if it's just structured as part of the local tax base, then there would be some TIF capture. TIF capture might be something that the legislature wants to think about and how that affects the general education levy.
And Madam Chair, just finally then, so if the tax base, whether it's net tax capacity or market value, is reduced at the local level because of the TIF, and the state is basing its equalizing dollars that it's paying to the school districts based on that tax capacity or market value, would the state dollars not be increased because of the TIF?
Madam Chair and Senator Skoy, if that were the case, then because that local tax base is captured and not available to pay that portion of the levy, then the levy might be higher than it otherwise could be if that tax base were available for the levy. But you need to consider if TIF is working really well and if TIF is actually generating the development and people are doing a good job of evaluating their but-for test, they would make the argument that that tax base would not exist without TIF, and so that the other taxing jurisdictions really aren't missing out on anything because the tax base wouldn't exist without taxing rent financing. And so it may boil down to whether, you know, how good of a job you believe the local authorities are doing in evaluating the but-for test, which can be, you know, subjective and tricky to determine. So,
thank you.
Madam Chair, then to continue, taxing rent financing, most people think of taxing rent financing being used by cities, but actually development authorities are the ones that make the decisions about taxing rent financing. And a lot of the development authorities are municipal entities such as EDAs or HRAs or the municipality. There are some county development authorities as well. The development authorities then are the ones that are capturing the revenues that are generated, and they're the ones that are creating the TIF districts in which that revenue is spent. As to our report's scope and methodology, the data that we're presenting to you today was reported by 426 of the active development authorities for the calendar year 2011. The reports for that were due in 2012, and this includes data on 1,810 TIF districts. Here's a map of where across Minnesota the development authorities are located. In greater Minnesota, there are 322 active development authorities, and switching over to the metro, there are 104 development authorities currently in the metropolitan area. Then looking at county development authorities, there are currently 15 counties through most likely their HRAs that have created development authorities and are using tax and grant financing.
Madam Chair.
Senator Dietzick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Are you defining metro as 5-county metro, 7-county metro, 11-county metro?
Mr. Nord.
Madam Chair, Senator Dietzick, for this map, we were just using the 7-county metro area.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, our next graph shows you for the entire span that the Office of the State Auditor has had oversight responsibility of tax and grant financing. This shows you the total number of tax and grant financing districts that have been in existence. And so you can see that the number peaked out in 2004 and has been in decline since as decertifications have outpaced new certifications of districts. So then looking again at the makeup of these TIF districts that we see statewide, again, currently there's 1,810. And looking at them, there are different types of tax and grant financing, and redevelopment districts are the most common type. Almost half of the districts that are in existence are redevelopment districts. Housing is the second most common type of district with 30%, and economic development at 17%. And then there are some smaller, different, more unique types of districts that make up a small share of the total statewide districts. Looking at the same information on number of TIF districts in the metropolitan area, you'll see that redevelopment districts are a little bit more common in the metropolitan area, with 60% of the districts being redevelopment districts. Housing, again, remains popular at 23% of the total. Economic development in the metropolitan area is only 8%, and many of the other types of districts are located in the metropolitan area. The same distribution of TIF districts in the greater Minnesota, you see the redevelopment districts is less common at 43%. Housing districts make up 34%, and economic development districts are 22%. And while the information isn't shown statistically on here, it's indicated in our report that out of all the economic development districts, over 80% of economic development districts are located in greater Minnesota. Here's a table of the amount of new TIF districts that are created each year for the last 5 years. So one of the items that we highlighted in our report was that in 2011, the total number of new districts was up by 72%. So we went from 39 new districts being created in 2010 to having 67 new districts created in 2011. And most notably, if you look at the line for economic development, you'll see that the number of economic development districts created jumped from 12 in 2010 to 33 in 2011. And this it's noteworthy that this correlates with the jobs legislation that allowed some looser restrictions on how economic development districts could be created. That was the 2010 jobs legislation. It allowed economic development districts to be established for broader purposes, and it also allowed existing districts to expend available tax increment in less restricted ways. And so we think that possibly that legislation has had a role in increasing the number of economic development districts created. Again, sticking with
Senator Dietzick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Going to that, back to that number of new. So if a district is recertified, is that considered a new district then, or is it? I know Minneapolis had some at some point in the last few years that were recertified. So is that considered then in this chart a new district, or is it somewhere else in your little chart?
Mr. Nord.
Madam Chair, Senator Dietzick, recertifications are unusual, that terminology, but you're correct that for in Minneapolis, and there were a number of districts that were called pre-79 districts, and those districts had a final deadline for decertification of 2009, but there was some legislation that allowed some of those districts to essentially be recertified as new districts, and those recertifications would have been included in this data. So again, still looking at the makeup of this chart, just shows the same data from the table, but kind of in a pie chart form that shows what share of the new district creations are of what type. And so economic development districts, again, were almost half of all the new districts created, with redevelopment districts being second most common and housing third. This, again, represents the same information on new district certifications. The top line is the total by year, and then the different colored lines or with the different symbols show you the levels of the different types of districts and where they've been at over the years. So you can see that the increase in the economic development district creations is really driving the increase in the total. So then the flip side of new districts being created is are the number of districts that are being decertified. This chart shows you how the decertifications are reflected by type. And so the most common types of districts to be decertifying currently are the redevelopment districts at 46%, but economic development districts are second most at 34%. And you would expect to see economic development districts as a large share of the number of decertified districts, because economic development districts have a duration limit of 9 years, whereas redevelopment districts have a duration of 26 years. And so the economic development districts are coming and going at a faster rate. This, again, is the same information. And what you might note here, in comparison to the previous chart about new certifications, the decertifications, the shapes of the lines may look similar, but the if you look at the axis on the left, the total volume of districts being decertified is higher, whereas we had about 69 new districts being created. We have over 120 districts being decertified in 2011. So the number of decertifications is outpacing the number of new districts, and that's been going on for the last 5 years. So now switching to the amount of tax increment revenue, or the tax increments themselves, you see statewide there's about $252 million of tax increment revenue being generated in 2011. 83% of that increment is coming from redevelopment districts. So whereas redevelopment districts were just under half of all districts, they represent 83% of all the increment that's being generated. Housing districts make up 10% of the increment. Economic development districts are 4%, and then the other districts at smaller percentages. This is shows you the amount of tax increment revenue generated in the metropolitan area, the seven counties. So you may note that about $210 million of the $252 million dollars in increment is being generated in the metropolitan area, even though only 35% of the total number of TIF districts are in the metropolitan area. So the metropolitan TIF districts are generally higher valued in creating a lot more increment.
Madam Chair.
Senator Skoy.
Mr. Nord, the pre-1979 district, is that going to go away at some point in the near future?
Never.
Mr. Nord.
Madam Chair, Senator Skoy, as I mentioned earlier, they were set to decertify in 2009, and many of these districts actually have decertified, but they continue to report to us until they've distributed and finally resolved all of their assets. And so some of those districts may still have, like, sales and lease proceeds or have some assets that they haven't yet distributed, and until that time they continue to report to us. And so those are so there are some decertified districts that are being reflected in this data. So here's the same distribution of tax increment, but for Greater Minnesota. Again, $42 million of the increment is being generated in Greater Minnesota. And you'll see that while redevelopment increments are still the lion's share of all increment, that the housing increment and the economic development increments are a more significant share of the pie than in the metropolitan area. And this represents the total amount of tax increment revenue generated over the last 10 years statewide. So you see we hit a peak in 2008. We had a couple of years of pretty sharp decline. In 2011, there was the amount of decline had largely stabilized. We might anticipate, though, future decline in this chart if decertifications truly are outpacing new certifications, and if the kind of the older districts tend to be the wealthier districts in terms of increment, and so as those begin to expire, total increments may decline.
Mr. Nord, is it the general assumption in the TIF community that the reason why these numbers are going down since 2008 is because of the general economic conditions, recession, or have you noticed any other Auditor Otto or any other things coming into play? Is it just the natural history of period where TIF was used a lot, and so the districts actually have a normal life of decertifying, or is it just we're not? Are they being decertified early? What could you just comment on that? Because almost all your slides, we're seeing this peak and then this fall off as an economic development tool for the local communities.
Madam Chair, in this, with regard to this graph, it's hard to know what impact the more recent economic conditions are having on this, because it generally takes a couple of years for TIF districts to get going and get increment generated. Mm-hmm. So a lot of the slowdown in the economy, may not truly be reflected in this chart, for example. I think what you might be seeing in this chart is the fact that throughout the 80s, there wasn't as much legislative controls in place regarding TIF districts. The districts were bigger, created a lot more increment, and as those now, especially the pre-79 districts, I think the drop from 2008 to 2009 reflects those pre-79 districts going away. Okay. And I think some of the continued decline in this graph represent those older districts decertifying. But if we went back to the table that we looked at here, you can see maybe what the current economy is doing to tax increment financing districts, because this is the new districts created each year. And so you can see that the 2009 levels and the 2010 levels of new district creation were down quite significantly from 2007 and 2008. Right. But the full impact of that on some of these other tables won't be felt until a few years down the road.
Okay, thank you.
So, yeah. Up here. Okay, so returned increment. When TIF districts receive more increment than is needed for the expenditures that they identify in their plan, they need to return that increment to the county auditors to be redistributed to the different taxing jurisdictions. And in 2011, there was just over $5 million returned to county auditors to go back into the property tax stream. This next table shows you the total amount of debt associated with tax increment financing districts, almost $1.7 billion of debt associated with TIF districts. It also shows you that pay-as-you-go notes and pay-as-you-go obligations are now becoming the most common type of arrangement for a TIF district. That may not have been the case back in the 80s, where maybe general obligation bonds were more popular. But 47% of the debt is in the form of a pay-as-you-go obligation. And so it's also important to note that the general obligation debt, which is 30% of the total, is the only category for which the taxpayers may be on the hook. Those general obligation bonds being backed by the full faith and credit of the taxing jurisdictions. If tax increments weren't enough to cover those obligations, the taxpayers may have to step in to meet those obligations. That 30% share of the pie is down from 31% last year, and so it's going down slightly. And pay-as-you-go primarily is becoming the most common type of financing. So we just...
Madam Chair.
Senator Kozelka.
Thank you. I just have a question related to that. Is that because the assessed values end up being lower than what they thought they were going to be, or why does that happen?
Madam Chair and Senator Gazelka, that could happen for a variety of reasons. It could be that they that the values of the properties or their projections of the increment stream were too optimistic and have gone down. It may occur from time to time from legislative changes if class rates are changed or tax relief is given. For example, you know, the market value homestead exclusion, if you have housing districts and now all the homestead or housing is getting a tax break in its tax base, that might affect the increment stream for those districts. So it can happen from, you know, market values. It can happen from their estimates. It can happen from, you know, projected development activity not occurring, and it can happen from changes to the property tax system.
Thank you. So.
The job stimulus program, again, I think it's important to note, given what we're seeing in some of the tables and charts that we've presented to you, to summarize what is happening with the jobs, the 2010 jobs program. And again, there were two types of authority that were part of that legislation. One was the looser restrictions on how you can create new economic development districts. Those had to have been certified by July 1st of 2012. And what we're aware of is 39 authorities creating 43 new districts. And again, you saw that 33 of those were created in 2011. The second element of that was looser restrictions on the use of increments from existing districts. All of those expenditures had to have been made by the end of 2012, by December 31st of 2012. And in Appendix C, we've summarized the 45 spending plans that we collected from 41 different authorities pertaining to 95 different TIF districts. So as you flip through Appendix B and C, you can get a flavor of what the outcome of the jobs stimulus program has been.
Mr. Nord, are you aware, again, within the TIF community of any districts or authorities that were not able to accomplish their purposes by these deadlines and that may be asking for an extension? Are you aware?
Madam Chair, no, we aren't aware of, okay. Haven't
just
heard
curious.
Much buzz about what.
We haven't had any bills presented to do that, but you never know.
Yeah. Okay. Finally, part of our report is the inclusion of different findings and responses we have from oversight capacity. And if you look to appendixes D, E, and F, you'll see the findings of noncompliance that were made in 2012 pertaining to three different municipalities. And so that kind of concludes the summary of our report. And if you have any questions.
And with regard to Duluth and Stillwater, your office is satisfied that the correct repayments have been made. And I notice that you say that you feel like the finding has been resolved. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, in this year's report, we didn't have Duluth and Stillwater. Are you referring to a previous year's?
Referring to a finding that I saw on page 24, where they made a, where is that, what year is that from?
So we had findings, Madam Chair, for the City of Cottage Grove, the City of Ramsey, and the City of Wyoming. And
I'm looking at page 20, in page 23 of your report. Where you have, just a second.
Madam Chair, I'm wondering if that might have been a previous year's.
Oh, darn.
Yeah.
I don't know. That's what I'm looking at.
This is a copy from this year.
I'm looking at that page 22 and 23. Is that from another year?
Madam Chair, I believe it must have been the three cities that we had findings for 2012 were just Cottage Grove,
okay.
Ramsey, and
all
Wyoming.
All right, I thought I was the most current year, but I guess that was not what was provided for me. But those have been resolved or not?
Madam Chair, in the current report, I know that there's still an ongoing issue with one of the findings with Cottage Grove. I'm being new enough, I'm not as familiar with the Duluth and Stillwater.
Madam Chair, if it's okay. So in these letters, we document whether findings have been resolved or not, and what we're required to do by law, if there's a finding that's not resolved, then we refer it to the appropriate county attorney. And then they have a period of time to do something or not, and then if they don't, I believe it, then it goes to the attorney general. Mm-hmm. Most of the findings were resolved satisfactorily in most of the cases here, but I believe for Cottage Grove, they didn't resolve finding 3, and so we forwarded it to the Washington County Attorney according to statute.
Okay, thank you very much. Are there any other questions for the State Auditor or Mr. Nord? Thank you very much. We appreciate your work in this area and keeping us up to date.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mm-hmm.
The next item on the agenda is a proposal from Senator Wieger, who is joined by Senator Kent. We'll get someone to help you with that. Mr. Nord, do you want to turn off your presentation for us or someone? And lower the screen, please.
Great. And Bob, pull up another chair.
And Senator Wieger, Senator Kent, we were sorry to read in the paper today about the shooting in Oakdale and the families of those folks that were harmed. Have our deepest sympathy. Senator Wieger.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, members of the committee. We appreciate your condolences for the community. Oakdale is in mourning, and we'd ask the mayor, who's been up all night, council members, and I would trust City Administrator Craig Waldron has not slept, but he's here. And
thank you very much.
When it hits home, it is especially tough. And that whole crime scene area is just a part, actually, of one of the TIF areas that we're going to talk about.
That's what I thought.
But those stores, they're open for business right now. And there's counselors and others at Oakdale Elementary, where the young boy was lost. And we'll move ahead. So thank you for those kind words. This is about the continued revitalization of Oakdale, Senate File 48, and we deeply appreciate the past support for the authorization for districts in Oakdale, and overall, this bill will extend the TIF districts from 2025 to 2031. We have a packet in here that shows the problem and progress that has been made. And particularly, there's been a great deal of work done to get rid of the structures, to put in some of the needed infrastructure that will make this place, each of these areas, ready for primetime development. There's a good deal of positive activity that's occurring. And you know where it is, and I know many of you have visited there. And so we want to say thank you and just make the pitch that we need some additional time to get the job done right. The district now, through reapportionment, also includes Senator Kent's, as the various districts for the TIFs are divided by the legislative district. And so I mentioned that Tartan Crossing is making very good progress, and the process has right now what we propose is about $670,000 would be needed, and it's identified for what would be used for that money during the time frame. And then we have the Tanner's Lake redevelopment, and Senator Kent's going to address that. And then if there's questions, we'll go further. But at this point, I'd like to ask Senator Kent to comment on the project and specifically Tanners Lake redevelopment.
Senator Kent, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, and thank you, members. I'm grateful to be here this morning and have a chance to talk about this really important project for this entire region, and that's sort of the point I want to make. I-94, 694, and 494 are a major crossroads, not just in Oakdale, but for the entire East Metro region. And as Senator Wieger said, our districts come together in this very area. The Tartan Crossing project is basically one exit west of that intersection, and the Tanners Lake, I'm sorry, I said that backwards. The Tartan Crossing project is basically one exit north of that intersection, and Tanners Lake is one exit west. It is all deeply connected right in there and very visible and a big important contribution to this region. Tanners Lake is right on 94. It is right next door to 3M and Maplewood, and you can see how interconnected these cities and this entire region is. We're just a few miles in from the visitor center when all our visitors are coming in from that side of the state. So to have some redevelopment here, the city has made tremendous progress, as Senator Wieger said, in correcting some of the initial problems, and the prospect and the, I would say, really the return on investment in these areas will be significant. So thank you so much for your time, and I'll turn it over now to our leaders from Oakdale and to give you some more details about the projects. Thank you.
Thank you.
And Madam Chair, Craig Waldron, the city administrator, and for those of you that may not know, he's been internationally recognized as one of the top city managers recognized in awards in the United States, but through peer groups on the globe. He's been with Oakdale for 20 years, has helped guide the growth with the city council and the mayors and commissions previously in Roseville. So,
Mr. Waldron, welcome to the committee, and again, Senate sympathies to you and your community.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. That that means a lot to us. It's been a difficult evening, and as you can imagine, our hearts go out to the family, and boy, I can't say enough about our police and fire and the reaction and everything that they've been through and got accomplished over the last 24 hours. So thank you for that. Very, very appreciated.
Mr. Waldron, you do need to identify yourself for the record.
Yes, Craig Waldron, city administrator for the city of Oakdale. If I could just add a little more context to the area that we're talking about. These two areas have been significant problems for the city almost as long as I can remember. And as the senator said, I've been there 20 years. You talk about blight. We've got some good blight examples for you here. But the first one, the senator pointed out, on Tanners Lake, is where we had what was known as Blackie's Bar, and we just had an incredible problem there. We had shootings, we had beatings, and this was the type of cancer that was starting to spread into the rest of the neighborhood. And fortunately, we've been able to get that under control. We've demolished the buildings, working with two of the private owners there. We've invested about $1.6 million in the adjacent neighborhood to get a handle on this and stop what I said was a cancer, and we're prepared to move forward with the new development. We have the developer that we've been working with, and now that we've been starting to crunch the numbers, we're seeing a gap appear, and that's why we're here asking for some additional years. The mall site also been a problem as long as I can remember. We had an absentee landlord from California, and the mall just continued to deteriorate. As you can see from the pictures, it ended up vacant. We have very interesting mold patterns that surfaced on the walls and so forth, and we were able to get that under control, and we have that mall demolished now. We have the new infrastructure in, and we have an agreement with the Wellington Company to move forward with a mixed-use project there. So we've been able to stop the blight there and get the new infrastructure in. But again, the same thing based on some of the changes in valuations and so forth. We're experiencing a gap there also. So that's why we're requesting the extensions. And Bob Streeter is here, Madam Chair, if you'd like a little more detail on how we're trying to get this accomplished. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Streeter, welcome to the committee. If you have additional comments, we would love to hear them.
Madam Chair, if you'd like, I can walk through the specifics of the bill if you'd like me to do that.
I think it's been a while since we've actually gone through the project.
Okay.
Provisions are included in the federal conformity bill, but I think for the benefit of the members who are new to the committee, it would be very helpful to us if you would do that.
Okay.
We do have your handout. If you could direct us where to look on the handout, that would be
okay.
Helpful.
Okay. Page looks like there's a section after a lot of the maps. It's City of Oakdale Special Legislation, and there's a table of contents that breaks the bill down into Section 34, Section 55, and Section 3. Well, it's page one of it should be it says
our
page
pages
one
aren't
on the top.
Numbered.
It should be like maybe page 17. There should be a table of contents.
Look like this?
Yes.
Okay. So
it's about midway through.
Yeah, about midway through, you'll see beginning a page one that is titled City of Oakdale Special Legislation, January 11, 2013, members. So if you want to follow along. Mr. Streeter.
Madam Chair, the first section of the bill, Section 34, the first piece, it's entitled Deemed Occupied. What that does is typically under tax increment law, a building must be demolished either by the city, financed by the city, or completed by a developer under a development agreement. We've been working with two private property owners, and one was a fairly elderly couple who wants to cooperate, and they went and tore down the building, and after we asked them to wait, and so it's kind of just a misstep on their part. And so what that means is, without this provision, that parcel cannot be included in the district, therefore it cannot generate increment, and that's the increment we need. So we're asking that.
It's a retroactive
yes,
provision so that we can pretend that it wasn't demolished too early. Is that
yes.
correct? Is that the effect of that?
Yes, we can pretend, yes,
yes.
Madam Chair.
Okay.
The second piece.
It's not the biggest pretense that
no,
we've ever had
no.
on tax increment, let me tell you.
Just wait till later. Yeah. The second piece is entitled A Deadline for Certification. From the time buildings are demolished, the district must be certified within 3 years or 36 months. And these buildings were demolished in 08 and 09, and because of the state of the economy and the difficulty getting financing, we weren't able to certify the TIF district because, of course, you have to have a developer, they have to get financing, we have to have a plan. So what we're asking to do is to extend that date of certification beyond 3 years, through December 31st, 2017, which we think would allow us enough time to continue to work with the existing developer, put a plan together, and certify the district.
In the original legislation that you had in a prior year, was that date the same, or was it a year earlier?
I think it was the same, Madam Chair.
Same? Okay.
Yes. if you move on to Section 55, and that has two subparts, Tartan Crossing Redevelopment Project and Tanner's Lake Redevelopment Project. And what that is requesting is to extend the existing Bergen Plaza TIF district. So Bergen Plaza is its own TIF district over here. It's not the Tartan Crossing district. It's not the Tanner's Lake district. And what this asks or requests is that we are able to extend that an additional 6 years to be able to take those proceeds to fund the gap that we're experiencing on Tartan and the gap we're experiencing on Tanner's. Specifically, In 2010, the legislature approved an 8-year extension on the Bergen District, and that was to generate about $2.8 million, and that was sufficient to pay for the infrastructure and the public costs at Tartan Crossing. But because of property taxes appeal, we're probably getting more like, instead of $350,000 a year, we're getting about $175,000 a year. So we're not asking for any more money. We're just asking for additional time to be able to collect the money that we had planned on getting anyway to pay for the roads, water, sewer, and the infrastructure. The related to Tanner's Lake, we've got about a $4 million gap, and part of the Bergen money would be used to fund and fill that gap. So if you think of Bergen Plaza generating this additional tax increment, part of it would go to Tartan, and part of it would go to Tanner's Lake. The total amount over 6 years we'd anticipate generating from Bergen Plaza is $1,500,000, with $670,000 going towards Tartan Crossing and $750,000 going towards Tanner's Lake. And then, Madam Chair and members, if you look at Section 3, which is the next section, this takes an existing district called the Echo Ridge TIF district that is now, it was a housing district. All of its obligations have been paid in full. We'd like to extend that district for a time, or the city's already extended it 10 years, but we'd like the ability to use that money at Tanner's Lake to help fill the gap that I mentioned earlier. And that's estimated to generate about $950,000. So if you think of the Bergen Plaza District and the Echo Ridge District, each are sending $750,000 to Tanner's Lake, and then again Bergen Plaza is sending $670,000 to Tartan Crossing. So, and then on the last page of this section, page 6, you'll see we've drafted a sources and uses, so you can see exactly what the money's being used for, where it's being used, and where it's coming from.
Okay, any questions for Mr. Streeter or Mr. Waldron, Senator Kent, or Senator Wieger on this proposal?
Madam Chair?
Senator Wieger.
Madam Chair, I just wanted to point out there are resolutions of support from Oakdale and the county. We don't have the resolution from the school board, and we'll get that. You have a letter from the superintendent, and the board does support it, but we'll have that official soon.
I note also that there's a letters of support from the Business and Professional Association, too, in Oakdale. Any other comments? Senator Wieger, Senator Kent, Mr. Waldron, Mr. Streeter, thank you very much for being here today in a very trying time.
Thank you. Again, thank you for your kind comments.
So we will lay over Senate File 48 for further consideration at a later time. We have one other bill, Senator Metzen, and it is Senate File 229. His testifiers are here. Before we move to that, we have a little bit of time. Mr. Carlson, I wonder if we could ask you to come and I see that Senator Skoy is not there just this moment, but you go back to 1991, correct?
Madam Chair, yes, I do.
So prior to 1991 and the TIF reform that was done then that created what cities call the LGA penalty, what I call the LGA offset, which became a point of contention through the 90s before the 2001 reforms. What was the mechanism by which the state reimbursed the school districts for the loss of tax revenue because of the decisions made by the City Economic Development Authorities. In the conversation that Senator Scoy and I, Senator Scoy recounted from that he and I and some others had earlier this morning, I could not recall whether it was a direct payment, whether it was an increase in the state aid that was sent to school districts, because as we know, when their ability to tax was or ability to have those captured revenues was not there, unlike cities and counties, which could increase their levy, the school district did not have that authority to increase their levy to deal with a tax increment financing decision made by an economic development authority. But I could not remember how that aid was paid to the cities. Do you or how it was paid to the school districts? Do you recall the mechanism?
Madam Chair, members, again, this is Gary Carlson with the League of Minnesota Cities. Madam Chair, I really am struggling to remember precisely how it functioned.
Well, okay.
I do remember that it originated in the House of Representatives. I think you were in the House at the time.
Yeah.
And I will do a little research for the committee and get back to you precisely as to how that worked.
Yeah, I know going forward from 1991 to 2000 what the general law provision was, but Senator Scoy and I were interested in how the state made good on that prior to that, and whether it was through additions to state aid, whether it was equalized, and we would really appreciate that information if you could dig into your files.
Madam Chair, I will do that, and I will bring it up to your office.
Terrific.
Senator
Scoy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Carlson, as I've been thinking about this morning, I think what was going on is the equalizing formula is a tax capacity per pupil unit. And as the increment, the TIF district reduces the tax capacity, then the amount that would decrease the tax capacity per student, which would increase the state aid per student. I think that's the mechanism.
Madam Chair, Senator Scoy, that is the mechanism as I understand it. So,
we're interested in knowing pre-1991 how that mechanism actually worked for any given school district where an economic authority, economic development authority, created a TIF district under the law,
yeah.
Either a special district or a regular one. Okay.
I will pull out of my files the information.
Good.
On how that worked.
Appreciate it. Senator Metzen, are you here? I see you. Welcome to the committee. You can ask your testifiers to come forward. We have Senate File 229 before us.
Good morning.
And you may welcome to the committee and proceed.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. This is an extension of a TIF district for West St. Paul. So it was passed last year when it was in the big tax bill that got vetoed.
Senator Metzen, could you bring a microphone in front of you for the tape, please?
Madam Chair, members, this is an extension of a TIF legislation in West St. Paul, and it's supported by the Dakota County CDA, Community Development Agency in Dakota County. West St. Paul is a first ring older suburb, and our gateway is filled with old, obsolete buildings built in the 30s, 20s, and 40s, and we're in dire need of replacing that Robert Street corridor. And I think that's probably the most heavily traveled two-lane highway, I think, in the state of Minnesota, if I'm not mistaken. And we've been able to get some federal funds to help us along the way, but this is for acquisition and clearance of these dilapidated buildings. And with that, I've got the mayor and some others here, and I'll let them.
Okay.
A little bit.
Welcome to the committee. Are you Ms. Brennan?
Yes, I am.
If you would identify yourself, please, for the For the record, if you would give us more detail about this proposal and why it's needed.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Andrea Brennan. I'm the Director of Community and Economic Development for the Dakota County Community Development Agency. The county CDA and the city have worked together for the last 26 years on the redevelopment efforts along South Robert Street, particularly focused on the Gateway, which is as you enter West St. Paul from St. Paul along South Robert Street. The TIF district is a 25-year redevelopment TIF district. It expired at the end of 2012. The request before you is to, in the proposed legislation, is to authorize the creation of a new tax increment district with a 15-year term with the same boundaries, base tax capacity, and project base tax capacity and statutory requirements as the previous district. So although the actual request is for creation of a new district, it has the same effect as extending the old district another 15 years.
That was a question that Senator Dietzick raised earlier with regard to the state auditor's report on how many districts are being created, which of them were in the report as new districts and which were actually recertifications of districts that were being decertified.
This is an extension of something that's not a new one, so Senator Dietzick was right on that point.
We've achieved a great deal in the last 25 years. We're about two-thirds of the way there. We've been able to acquire about 4 acres of property. On the second page of your handout, you can see photos of some of the properties that we've acquired. We've demolished several of the structures. Most of them, well, they were all substandard. Most of them were constructed in the very early 1900s or even late 1800s. So we've completed a lot of that land assembly, demolition, and we've even completed some of the redevelopment, namely a new 60-unit affordable senior housing development with commercial on the first floor, and that's right on the corner of Annapolis Street and South Robert Street, and so that's right as you enter West St. Paul from St. Paul. So while we've completed a great deal, we still have a great deal to do. We need additional TIF resources are required in order for redevelopment to occur. We need to complete the site assembly, again, particularly in that Gateway block area. We have about an acre left to acquire. We have some properties left to demolish and some infrastructure to install in order to create the necessary incentives for a market response to this redevelopment effort.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is John Zandmiller. I'm the mayor of West St. Paul.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Some of you may be new here, so I'll tell you right now, West St. Paul is south of us. Is due to some faulty compasses that were given to us when we incorporated. But if you take Robert Street right here from the Capitol down, you'll come into our city.
It must be west of something, so it's okay, right?
West of Washington County.
West of New York.
There we go.
There you go.
The western frontier. As you come down Robert Street, you will see this block immediately. It was something that we've been working on for a decade before I was even elected. It's taken a while to put these things together, but it is a gateway, and I believe that it can be a gateway that also spurs development on its own north of Annapolis into St. Paul and benefits both cities. But we're here to talk about our block, which is we call the Thompson-Langula block because it represents some of the earliest businesses on that block. The Langula family has been a regular and continuous presence on Robert Street for 100 years. But the problem is that the way things were built and operated 100 years ago just doesn't work today. We've got a shallow block to redevelop, and we have to have this ability under the extended TIF to make things happen. We want to have it continue to be a thriving commercial corridor. Why is that important to everyone else? Well, at last check, we generate about $19 million a year in sales tax revenue alone off Robert Street. That comes directly to the state to help the state meet its mission. We think it's in everyone's best interest to keep that economically viable and support business to come in there, creating jobs and additional growth on its own. We do not believe that we will be able to accomplish redevelopment without this. It makes sense for all of us. It makes sense not just for my community, but for neighboring communities and beyond. If I may add just one thing, please visit many of our merchants in West St. Paul. They appreciate your patronage.
Mr. Mayor, why is it that this project comes from the county community development agency as opposed to an economic development authority associated totally with the city of West St. Paul?
That all started.
What's the history of that? I think.
Well,
that would be
again,
helpful.
This district started long before I was even elected. But, Madam Chair, if you'd like, I'll have my community development director brief you on this.
Sure.
Thank you, Madam
welcome
Chair.
To the community committee. If you would identify yourself, please, for the record.
My name is Jim Hartshorn. I'm the community development director for the city of West St. Paul.
Mr. Hartshorn.
Thank you very much for hearing us today. It goes back quite a ways, long before our community development department was even formed. We weren't even a department until 12 years ago. The district is actually about 20 years or older, actually longer, I think 25 years actually. Part of the reason why is that the district, when you decertify a district, you can no longer create a new district and count all of the parcels that were once in that district. So the district would not be worth as much if we decertified and then just created a district later on. We don't know if it would generate enough increment to where it would afford us the opportunity to buy some of the more of the
That's actually not my question.
I'm sorry.
My question was, why is this coming? What's the history of the county having a community development agency proposing a TIF district as opposed to the city of West St. Paul doing okay. it? Does West St. Paul have an economic development authority?
We do. We certainly do.
And why isn't this coming? Why wasn't this done through? I'm just curious, not critical, but why was it done through the county rather than the city?
Okay. Financially, it made more sense because the income can generate more if it's an expansion, and the CDA is the administrator of that district. So,
good. Take a shot at
that. Oh, go ahead.
Madam Chair, I can attempt to answer that as well. The Dakota County Community Development Agency has worked in partnership with many of the cities within Dakota County. We have on-staff expertise in the areas of housing and redevelopment, and we have worked with the City of West St. Paul, EDA. We have a joint powers agreement between the CDA and the EDA in which we share some of the redevelopment responsibilities. So in some instances, the City EDA has used increment from the district to acquire parcels, and sometimes it has been the CDA. So we've worked very closely with the staff capacity, the expertise, and the powers of both agencies to affect this redevelopment.
Are there any separate TIF districts in West St. Paul from the ones that are authorized by the County Development Agency? Just curious.
Yes, we have three others.
Yep. Three others. What is the timeline for their decertification?
One will be decertified by the end of June, and we are using some of the pool TIF funds from that district to help in our central area, which is not included in this area, our gateway district. And we have two others. One will be decertified within the next 5 or 6 years, and the other one is very similar to that. That'll actually be decertified even quicker, probably in the next 2 years. So very small districts, though.
Mr. Mayor, what's the population of West St. Paul?
19,495.
There you
Happy
go.
Residents.
Thank you.
Yes.
Okay,
We don't want to break that 20,000 mark because then our league membership fees go up. And
I see.
Burgeoning restraint until the next census.
We'll leave that policy alone. But about 20, just under 20,000. Okay.
We don't have any land just because of West St. Paul. It's all built up.
Mm-hmm. The I see in your handout that the legislation itself is modeled after the South St. Paul TIF legislation that you brought in 2009. How is that project going?
South St. Paul?
The South St. Paul 2009 TIF project. How is that going?
Very well. Brief history. South St. Paul, about 30 years ago, lost 7,800 jobs when Swifts and Armors left, and it was just devastating. It was more than one-third of our tax base. So quite frankly, we've been fighting back ever since. And they took up about 300 acres down in the river flats, and when they left, it was just chaos for our community. And that's why, and the TIF thing is really, that's an example, I think, Madam Chair and members, how these things should work. We're still fighting back. Now we're diversified, which we weren't at that time, and we depended and relied on just that tax base. But it's going very well.
And was that a city-specific economic development? It was not the community development agency.
It's not the CDA. Okay, Dakota County.
Just curious.
They have a port authority and an HRA on their own, and that's why I think these folks kind of patterned after the success. I believe the success of South St. Paul, but it's taken a long time.
Are there any questions or comments for Senator Metzen or the mayor or his testifiers? Thank you very much,
thank you very much.
Presentation.
This is extremely
and
critical for West
Senate,
St. Paul.
Senate File 229 is laid over. It also is part of the tax conformity bill that we have in the full committee at this point. Would you please hand back in those blue books that you got from the state auditor? Mr. Carlson.
Madam Chair, members, I phoned a friend, and I now remember how it all worked. And I understand that you were very involved in the legislation that governed this back in the House of Representatives. So,
I was the chief author.
Yes. Essentially, how it worked was the Department of Education computed the school aids as if the school district was receiving those aids based upon their tax base, including the captured increment value. The difference between the actual calculation and the calculation as if they had all the captured value was then computed as a penalty that was applied to the city's LGA, and if they did not have sufficient LGA or did not receive LGA, it was applied to their HACA, the Homestead and Agricultural Credit Aid that was distributed at the time.
Mr. Carlson, what that part I'm familiar with. What Senator Scoy and I were interested in is what was happening prior to the reforms in 1991. How did the state make up the difference between between those two values?
And Madam Chair, as I understand it, it was a calculated amount, but that there was nothing that actually triggered any repayment prior to the 91 changes. Now, I may be wrong on that.
That's not the question. The question is the state paid the difference. Was it in a separate check? Was it in through the state aid formula? How was the school district made whole from the TIF decisions made during the 1980s? That's the question we'd like you to look up.
I will have to do more research, Madam Chair.
Not after 91. I know what happened then. Tomorrow we will have some discussion of the Department of Revenue's report on tax expenditures. Not the tax expenditure budget itself, but its report on that. And we'll be looking at that in the context of Senator Reinert's bill, following one of the recommendations in that report to establish a commission to review tax expenditures and make reports back to the legislature about which one should be sunsetted, which one should be continued. So without if there are no further questions, committee stands adjourned.